Perfect. Well, I guess to kind of start off with, I'd love to hear from Ron about when you picked up Mark's book and first realized your connection to this and what that must have been like for you.
Sure. It was a thrilling moment, to be sure. I was in a bookstore just browsing books, and there was a stack of new books that for some reason I felt attracted to, wasn't sure why. And I sort of walked over to it and noticed that there was a book there that had a photograph that I'd never seen before, but I recognized one of the people in the photo as my grandfather. I was like, oh, that's my grandfather John Voorhees at a very young age. And then I noticed the title of the book called The Millionaire's Unit, and then I thought, oh, okay, I know what that is. That is the story about the first Yale unit, because I knew this story from some family history, but I certainly didn't know the detail that Mark put into it in his book. We had no idea that the book was being published in my family, and so that was the nice surprise that I discovered in the bookstore that day.
So how do you guys know each other? Derek, can you explain y'all's connection, you and Ron?
Well, Ron and I met in college at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And we were in a theater company together in New York, and we both moved out to Los Angeles in the early 90s, and Ron got the idea of possibly making a documentary, and I've been working in documentary television a number of years, and he called me up to see if I was interested, and kind of forced me to read the book, and I thought, well, that's a pretty great story. And I work mostly in history, and I really like the challenge of trying to make history come alive as much as possible, and rather quickly, Ron and I got very excited at the prospect of filming airplanes, and luckily there was a collection up in Central California of World War One planes, all of which had original engines, and they were so distinctive and so unusual, and I thought if we could capture those on film and get the audience to really understand what it took to fly these delicate and yet, for the time, very sophisticated planes, I thought we could have a real movie there.
And also, you guys found more planes courtesy of going to New Zealand, is that correct? Can you explain kind of how y'all found out about that and just utilizing those planes as well? There's some fascinating story there.
Yeah, we realized we needed a Sopwith Camel, and in this Central California collection, they had one with an original rotary engine, and it's a very distinctive sound. And two of our characters, one of them Dave Ingalls, was the Navy's only ace in World War One, and he won that title in a Sopwith Camel. And then Kenny McLeish, who's maybe the most romantic character, lost his life in a Sopwith Camel just a few weeks before the end of the war. And there are only three in the world, as far as we could tell. One was mothballed in England. Our friend Javier up north didn't want to get up in the air with a helicopter, and he said, "That's just not what my collection's about." And the other one belonged to Sir Peter Jackson, the director of Lord of the Rings and Hobbit movies. And he is a huge World War One aviation aficionado. And we got in touch with his company and told him what we wanted to do and how much money we had. And he said to come on out, and we did. And they could not have been more friendly, more helpful. Everybody pitched in at a discount, from the pilots to Peter rented us two red cameras. We got a local helicopter company, which was very expensive, but they still gave us a discount. We could only afford them for about 3 hours. We got this very sophisticated camera mount and filmed with that, and then we had about 3 days shooting out of a Cessna, and we probably filmed a dozen planes, but mostly the Sopwith Camel, the British SE-5s, and the German Fokker DR-1s were the main planes that we shot with. and we got everything we needed.
You know, Ron, you've already talked about your connection directly to that unit, but some of your producers, Henry and Mike, are obviously connected, and I was shocked to find out that even Bruce Dern was connected. This must be something really hard-hitting. It's hitting y'all's family. This is an important story, but it's very personal and close.
Yes. I mean, the film itself really developed out of the connections with the family members of the Yale unit. At the time that we began, it was a very small number of people, but I was invited to sit on a panel in New York City that was hosted by Mark Wortman, and it was about his book. And on that panel was Harry Davison, who was the grandson of Truby Davison. And it turned out a number of other Yale unit family members were at that particular event. And that was sort of the beginning of how the families came together two generations later to start to take on this notion of making a documentary. And what happened was, over the period of 7 years that it took to make the movie, we ended up meeting several of the other family members of descendants of the original first Yale unit pilots. And, you know, in addition to being a historical documentary, it was also a process of a rekindling of these various families. And what I found, because I met pretty much everybody that we interviewed, was that the story of the Yale unit was something that was extremely dear to the hearts of the Yale unit family descendants. And almost all of them had some sort of memorabilia from the period, like photographs and journals, and even at times, you know, physical objects that they had back then. And they gave everything to us. I mean, they said, yes, you can use this in your documentary. So that's how we came up with a lot of the imagery in the film, was through contributions by the Yale unit family members.
You know, I was blown away by some of the poignancy of the letters that were written, and it must have been kind of difficult to see the emotion, especially when certain members started to you know, get lost or pass away or die in World War One. Can you guys talk about going through this material? What you know, caused you to want to make sure that this was part of the film? But it really became, I think, the kind of, throughout the film, we have these beautiful letters and moments with these men that come directly from them.
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about it, and I'm sure Derek will also have some reflection on it. But just in terms of my own grandfather's letters, there was a trove of about 200 letters that my aunt had saved from this period of time, from like 1916 to 1918. And Mark Wortman, when he was doing his book, actually did never access this particular trove of letters. And so I, over a two-year period, I transcribed all 200 letters. And we used literally just a few lines out of those letters in the movie. But yes, it was emotionally, it was a turbulent time for these young men. I mean, they went over there with a great deal of enthusiasm and idealism. And then, you know, all of a sudden your best friend is missing, you know, and they didn't really know how to get information about who was missing or what had happened to them. And their letters are just so poignant and, as you say, heartfelt in describing their own feelings. I mean, the thing that's really interesting is, you know, back then letters were the major source of communication. You know, there was no internet. There was nothing like that. So they had to put everything into words, into letters, handwritten. And my experience was just you know, I was very touched by these letters. But Derek also, he went through more letters than I did. You know, I did those 200, and there were some others I went through. But Derek, I think, went through thousands of letters. So I'll let him talk about it for a little bit.
It's a real pity that Mark did not access Ron's grandfather's letters, because John Boris is a very good letter writer, and he's very witty and very funny. But the unique thing, that it was sort of a blessing in disguise for us, you know, that huge dramatic moment where Truby Davison crashes and is not able to go on as a pilot and does not get his wings. The whole group was so traumatized, and they all got their wings, and most of them, I think all but four of them, wound up overseas by the end of the war. But they all wrote letters back to Truby, and so there's a cache of letters at the Sterling Library of Yale that are from all of these guys. And so I spent several weeks in the library going through them, and in the end, we just got them all photocopied and chose that we wanted to use. But it's a very intimate way of getting to know the pilots. And I went to Europe to film particularly two of the graves of the pilots who lost their lives. And it was incredibly moving to be at Kenny McLeish's grave, having read all of his love letters to his fiancée, whom he never got to marry, and the letters back home to his parents, and to be above ground of his remains, where he was left overseas. It was hugely moving, and I hope some of that comes across in the film. But not only was this pre-internet days, but journalists were not allowed up to the Western Front. And so there were many Americans who wanted to get into the war, even though President Wilson wanted us to be neutral. And, of course, France very much wanted the United States to come in. And the main way Americans learned about the war was letters home. And very quickly, they'd be published. You know, the war started in 1914. By 1916, there are collections of letters from ambulance drivers and from aviators letting the United States know what was going on over there.
You know, it was definitely poignant, and I mean, some of the best moments. I really appreciated seeing that. I was heartbroken by a lot of those. So thank you guys for taking the time to put that into the film. I've got to ask, you know, there are sections of when you're looking back in the Yale history that you get to touch upon secret societies, and this was also a fascinating part of the film. How in depth were you able to get in with that from the letters and from the family members? And I mean, that's just fascinating unto its own self, the history of the Skull and Bones and the different societies that were part of Yale that these men were a part of.
I can talk about that, but Ron, would you like to?
Well, I mean, what I can say is, in terms of the letters and detailing what went on in the secret societies, that wasn't covered very much in the letters that I had, but for me, I was fascinated by the whole secret societies. And as our historian says in the film, Gaddis Smith, he says that, you know, that the secret societies were like hugely important for the male students. You know, wanting to get into one of them, it was like a big deal for people to get into it. I just know that they all aspired to it, and the ones who got into the various societies, it was very, very important for them to get in. You know, we at one point, one of the discoveries was we uncovered a photograph of the guys in our movie who all got into Skull and Bones, a photograph of them in Skull and Bones with a Skull and Bones, actual Skull and Bones, in front of them. I was like, what? So that was quite a surprise. And that came from the Lovett collection of photographs. And I was like, I thought that was an amazing find when we came across that. We sort of danced around the whole subject of it because the membership often goes down through families, and one of our producers, Harry Davison, is the grandson of Truby Davison, and he's a member of Skull and Bones, and you're a member for life,
and his father was a member, as well as Truby Davison. And so, you know, they don't really talk about it, but looking at their letters, the Skull and Bones members to each other always wrote a number, and I can't remember what the number was. It was something like 368. And I never knew what that number meant, and I never asked Harry. But there were also several other phrases they would use that were rather, you know, meaningless to us. But we thought it worked fine for the movie to keep it rather secretive. And one question we get asked fairly regularly is, why didn't Kenny McLeish get into Skull and Bones? And he doesn't say in his letters. He just says, I know why, but we've never really known.
I've got to ask about...
One other aspect of it is Harry did show us the machine gun from Guy Gates' stab in which he crashed is mounted on the wall at Skull and Bones, and Harry showed us a photograph of it, and so that was kind of fun.
Very cool. I've got to ask, with having two directors, how you guys work together. I know kind of Ron, you were a little bit of camera work and you know, but as far as how you guys work in directing, who does what and what happens on what days, like how do you guys make this happen?
Yeah, I mean, I can talk a little bit about it, and I'm sure Derek also will. You know, we started the project with very little money and very little connections, and so... You know, we had basically a bare bones production crew, which was me and Derek. Later on, Derek helped. But what ended up happening in the very beginning of the process is that I went out and interviewed a few of the descendants of the Yale unit, and so I was sort of doing everything in that particular case. What we did is Derek and I would discuss the questions to be asked of the interview subject, and so we had a game plan going in that he and I both agreed on. And then once I got to the location, I would actually be setting up all the lights, putting the mic on the subject, trying to make sure that the camera was in focus, which sometimes it wasn't. And then I would interview the person. So I was sort of directing that in a way. But then, you know, later on, Derek and I got to the point of both of us doing interviews where I was more on the camera and Derek was doing the interviewing. So mostly what we would do is we would discuss everything in advance. And then, you know, we just take on different roles at the particular shoot. Like, for example, in New Zealand, we discussed what we wanted to get in terms of the shots with the airplanes, and I had access to a 3D application, so I was doing visualizations of what we were trying to come up with, and we go back and forth, yeah, the plane should be here or there. So we kind of both worked on conceptualizing how those shots would go. But I realized very quickly that it was going to be a total confusion for the pilots if they had more than one person telling them what to do. So when we got to New Zealand, I pretty much left all the direction up to Derek, and he did a great job at it. But so, as you know, we went back and forth depending on what was what the actual circumstances were. But also, Derek, being the writer, had a huge influence on the shape of the film. And though we went back and forth many times with different iterations of the script and the edit, with both of us having a lot of influence, you know, Derek had a lot in terms of laying out the groundwork and the structure of the film. So, you know, we had both had different influences, I would say. But Derek, maybe you talk a little bit about your experience as dual directors.
Well, I think you pretty much covered it. You know, generally Ron would take care of more technical aspects of the film, and I would do more of the research and the writing and story shape. But we always made sure we were on the same page as far as those big decisions went. And we always reviewed everything together and had
many long talks on the phone and meetings, and then sort of tag team, you know, if one of us would flag in some way, you know, because we're also fundraising the entire time. And, you know, I wrote hundreds of letters, you know, asking for money and keeping people informed. Ron put together a quarterly newsletter, which, you know, we would do a profile of one of the pilots and just talk about where we were in production and what we needed. And so that's pretty much why it took 7 years. But in the end, you know, we raised $1 million. Our friend, the film producer, Fred Roos, we told him about the film early on. He said, so that's going to be like a $1 million picture. And I said, oh, no. It'll be $350,000, and we should finish it 2.5 years. But, you know, as we kept working on it, the story kept getting bigger, and we got bigger ideas, and we would dream. We would think, God, wouldn't it be incredible to go to New Zealand and be able to work with Peter Jackson's airplane collection? And it came up, and we told everybody, we said, we need to fundraise for this, and it came together. So Fred was right. It was a $1 million picture, and it took 7 years.
Yeah. I'll just throw in just one little tidbit on the directing, and I remember that when we were going to film in Europe, we looked at our resources at the time, and basically I determined that as a producer on the film that we didn't really have that much money, but we did have enough money to send Derek to Europe solo. So he went over there on his own with a camera and did a lot of shooting at various locations all around Europe. And of course, he discovered things along the way that we couldn't plan for in advance. And just to give you one example, he figured out that there was a ferry going from England over to Belgium, and that it would pass by one of the key locations in the story. And he got lucky because the ferry went right past the end of the mole, which was a big location in the film near where the Germans had their submarines, and got an incredible shot of the end of the mole, just kind of going around it, and it's like very prominent in the movie. So there was you know, as much pre-planning as we did, there were things that came along a little bit on the spur of the moment that just add a lot more to the film.
Just being able to be out on the North Sea, you know, where these guys were doing these submarine patrols, and it was an overnight, I don't know, it was a 12-hour journey, but it was in the middle of the summer, so it didn't get dark till about 11 o'clock, and then the sun rose at 4 in the morning, and so I got beautiful sunsets, you know, and there aren't many shots from it, but quite a variety of feels for what the sea looked like. My sister and her family lived in London, so I was able to use their house as a base, and that's how I took my trips to Belgium and France.
You know, for my final question, guys, I find it really amazing that your VOD release is very much connected to the history of these men, and in particular the Albert, the first one who fell. But can you talk a bit about that, but also about being able to showcase the memories of those guys that didn't come home, and what it means to have a movie that definitely gives us a way to look at these gentlemen and what they were able to accomplish for us here at home and those that are abroad as well?
Yes. I mean, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Al Sturtevant story, because my grandfather was intimately involved in it, in that prior to Al's patrol, the situation was that my grandfather, John Voorhees, had been flying rather regularly on these patrols out of their base at Felixstowe, and the weather had been really bad, so Al's flights had been canceled, but then it came up that the weather got better. My grandfather was scheduled to go on another patrol, and Al said, "Hey, would you mind if I, you know, I think we can go to the CEO and get permission for me to take your place on the plane. And my grandfather said, well, okay, let's try for it. So they went to this commanding officer and they said, could we switch for this particular patrol? And the CEO eventually said, yes, you can do that. So the patrol that Al Sturtevant went out on was actually originally scheduled for my grandfather to go out on, and that was where they came under attack from the German seaplanes, and Sturtevant's airplane was shot down. And to give you an example, Al was the second pilot on that particular flight, and the second pilot's job was to get in terms of air conflict, was to get in the front nose of the airplane where they had an opening and a machine gun there, and to take on the enemy. So there's this drawing that was a very faint drawing that my grandfather did after that all happened of an airman in the nose of this flying boat firing on a German plane attacking him. And I'm almost positive that that drawing was meant to be of Al Sturtevant taking on the Germans on his last flight. So in that regard, you know, there's a direct connection between Voorhees and Sturtevant, and Sturtevant was the first uniformed U.S. naval aviator killed in combat in World War I. So, you know, that story is very, very poignant for me, and I think I've shed a few tears over over Al Sturtevant passing a number of times.
For me, I've always loved history since I was a little kid. I started a club in second grade where we wrote biographies of the U.S. presidents. And to me, history is so interesting, but I know that a lot of people find it abstract and have a hard time getting into it. But if you can personalize it, and, you know, these guys did very significant things for the United States during World War I. And so to be able to bring history alive through their stories, and not just the reading of their letters, I really hope that the ephemera we use, you know, Ron shot some of the original letters, those letters of Robert Lovitz are the real thing that their family let us shoot. I made a mock-up of one of John Voorhees' letters that we filmed, and the tactile things of history. I hope that really comes alive and lets the story have more resonance as we hear the personal feelings of these guys that are connected to these very large movements in American history, in European history.
Yeah, and I'd also like to say that, you know, over the course of getting the film together and meeting all the family members and putting the story out there as a historical documentary, I often felt that part of our mission with making the movie was actually dedicating the film to the efforts of these young men who sacrificed and were willing to sacrifice so much for our country. And then those who came back after the war went on to have quite a bit of career in terms of serving their country with roles in public service. One of them became the Secretary of Defense. My grandfather was a 10-term congressman, and there were many other contributions in business and government.